That was a little bit of Spartacus from Branford Marsalis's album Crazy People Music from 1990. Branford Marsalis is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance Podcast, which is part of the OSIRIS Podcast Network. Visit OSIRISPod.com to see all the other shows that they offer, which cover a broad range of topics from music to craft brewing to comedy to mental health. I'm sure if you check it out, you'll find something else that will be of interest to you. And if you'd like to support Burning Ambulance and this podcast, please visit patreon.com/burningambulance. For just $5 a month, you'll get exclusive content, including some extended podcast episodes and some other stuff, so consider signing up at patreon.com/burningambulance. Branford Marsalis, for those who don't know, is a saxophonist and the older brother of Wynton Marsalis, the trumpeter and the leader of jazz at Lincoln Center. They're from New Orleans, and they started out working together, first in Art Blakey's band and then on each other's albums. They were already on separate paths by the mid-80s, though, when Wynton started becoming more and more of a traditionalist and Branford joined Sting's band. He was also the band leader on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno from 1992 to 95. He played with the Grateful Dead on stage several times in the early 90s and has guested with other jam bands since then. He played on Public Enemy's Fight the Power. Basically, he's a much more adventurous musician than people may sometimes think. I've been a fan of his work for a lot of years. Albums like Crazy People Music, The Dark Keys, Contemporary Jazz, Bragtown, and 4MF's Playin' Tunes are all really impressive high-level acoustic jazz without being so complex that they're alienating. His current band is Joey Calderazzo on piano, Eric Rivas on bass, and Justin Faulkner on drums. Justin's been with him for 10 years, and the other two guys have been around for like 20. They've got a new album, The Secret Between the Shadow and the Soul, coming out in early March, and it's really, really beautiful stuff. I expect it's going to be a record I come back to a lot over the course of the year. I'm going to play a piece from that album in a minute, a version of Snake Hip Waltz, which is a composition by Andrew Hill, and after that, you'll hear the interview. I should let you know, in case you've never heard an interview with Branford Marsalis before, that much like his brother, he has a lot of opinions about what is and isn't jazz, and he's more than willing to express negative judgments of other artists' work. So you should be prepared for that when listening to this conversation. It's a fun one. Anyway, here's Snake Hip Waltz, and then you'll hear my conversation with Branford Marsalis.
Thank you.
It's been 7 years since your last purely instrumental album with this band. Why did you allow so much time to pass between records?
I didn't. It just passed. I didn't allow it. It just passed. I mean, we worked with Kurt, and we didn't finish tours and all of that stuff with that record until July of 2017.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that tour ended in July, and then from there we took a month off and started playing with the group again, and we went into the studio in October to record some things, and it didn't work out well at all because the sound of the band, like any time when you make a drastic shift, like doing what we were doing to playing with Kurt, it's like you know, suddenly you're playing in a box that you weren't playing in before. And when you stay in that box long enough, it changes you. So what we were trying to do is play the way the band played in 2015, and that's gone. So we had to take some time, you know, cancel the recording date, go on the road and figure out what the new sound of the band was. And it took us a little while to do it. But then when we got it, we had so many gigs lined up that we had to then find a time to actually record it.
Uh-huh.
And it was just, I was just blasted from January to June. And it wasn't a decision. It's just life happens.
Yeah.
Then we had a gig, and we had some gigs in Tokyo that got canceled. So we had 5 days off in the middle of an Asian tour. So instead, we left Korea, we flew to Melbourne, and we did the record there.
You wrote one tune for this record, and you typically only write one or two per album, I think, when I went and looked back. Do you enjoy composing?
Right.
Or do you prefer to have other people? Sorry?
I'm indifferent to it. I like composing. I just don't, you know, when I look back at my heroes, they didn't write any of the songs. I mean, Lester Young wrote 3 or 4 songs. Charlie Parker wrote 3 or 4 songs, and or 10, but only 3 or 4 of them are really good songs. It's just, yeah, I decided I wanted to play jazz, and I wanted to be a player. And there are a lot of people who write great songs. Why not play their songs? I'm not interested in the genius trap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't need to be called a musician and a composer, because if, you know, I write songs, and I'm a fucking composer, then we have to get another definition for what Richard Strauss and Beethoven and Mahler and Mozart and those guys. We don't do the same thing. So if they're composers, then we're just songwriters.
Uh-huh.
You know, but for the majority of the history of jazz, guys wrote occasionally but didn't write a lot of songs. They were more interested in group interplay and playing. I'm good. I just don't, it's not that big a deal to me. I write other things. I write for Broadway shows and, you know, not Broadway shows, but for musicals.
Mm-hmm.
For plays, not for musicals. Musicals are a different animal entirely. It's impossible. You got to basically do that as a career to succeed at that. But I'll write incidental music for plays, and yeah, it's you know, like Revis and Joey think that it's important, so they're writing all the time. And if they write songs that I like, we'll play them. I mean, it's really, I just don't, you know,
mm-hmm.
I don't care that much.
Yeah, yeah. Who brought in the Keith Jarrett and the Andrew Hill pieces on this record, and what did you like about them?
I brought in the Keith Jarrett piece.
Mm-hmm.
Revis brought in the Andrew Hill piece.
Mm-hmm. And what did you like about them that you've thought made them a good fit for this album?
I mean, the Keith Jarrett song is just a great melody, and it's happy, and it's inspired by Ornette Coleman. And, you know, I spent a lot of time learning how to sound like Ornette and to play his style. I thought it was a good opportunity to, it's a happy song.
Mm-hmm.
It's a happy song. There are not enough happy songs in jazz these days that aren't campy.
Mm-hmm. You know,
the version of happy songs are like bad blues songs. You know, that kind of shit. But this is a legitimately happy composition. So, I enjoyed it, and I knew we could stretch on it and do our thing. It was great. I knew we were going to have a lot of fun doing it. And Snake Hip Waltz is the same thing. It's a happy song. But because it's in 3/4 and because of the chord structure, that's a totally different sound than it would be on Windup.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the songs, you know, like we have three happy songs, you know, Joey's tune, Sienna, in those two, Windup and Snake Hip Waltz. And that's nice. Usually we don't have a lot of happy songs on the record.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that you mention Ornette, because he's somebody who, I mean, obviously was hugely focused on being a composer, and you can tell it's one of his pieces in about three notes.
Right. Well, I mean, he wrote a lot of songs. His compositions, like Skies of America, is just garbage. I mean, it's just, that's not good composition at all. But, I mean, he had this window. You know, especially like that window with his great band with Charlie Hayden and Billy Higgins and Don Cherry. Man, some of that stuff is just incredible. You know, and it's more about how he heard sound. That's the thing that made it. You know, because when you hear the way they play those songs, I mean, it's funny hearing modern players, and they take his songs and they round off, you know, or they put edges where they used to be round. You know, so all of this, so they take all of his songs and they put in a concrete 4/4 structure, and a lot of his songs can't be put in that structure, so they don't play those. So there's a limit to which songs that are more often played by a lot of musicians, because if they have a real strict metric sense of playing music, like everything has to be in a specific meter and everything has to go to one. And Ornette's role in life was to push against that structure and to stretch it out. So everything was around one and around the place, but not exactly on a place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the linear style of playing, really, it's hard to play Ornette's music if you're a linear thinker. But I'm not. So I was, you know, I love his music.
Yeah, yeah. So how do you, in general, how do you assemble material for a record? Do you tell the other guys, like, we're recording in a month, so bring in some tunes? Or
yeah, that's what I do. I say, we're recording. And then they start bringing in tunes. Or we're playing and somebody says, I got this tune. Let's start playing it. But it's you know, the record thing is just, you know, it's we're not in the pop music business, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we don't make a record and then go out and tour the record and then take a couple of years off to write songs or whatever. We're touring musicians. That's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So when we decided we were going to make a record, it was more just the guy saying, man, I think we should record this stuff. It wasn't like, okay, we're going to do a record and it has to happen here, and then the record's going to come out and then we're going to tour. I mean, we tour for a living. This is what we do. We, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long is this tour going to be? It's been 30 years and counting.
So you do premiere music?
How many cities is this tour going to be? I said, oh, you know, hundreds by the end of the year. It's just, you know, it's not, we don't do that thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think in those terms. I don't think in you know, entertainment / pop music terms, because I understand what it is that we do.
Yeah, yeah.
And where we fit and where we are.
Mm-hmm.
So when we were making, so it wasn't like, you know, guys, we're going to make a record in 6 months, bring tunes. It's like, man, bring in tunes. And then a lot of the tunes that were brought at the date. And then I realized, I said, these tunes are great, and we're not going to play them well on this date. So let's cancel the date, go out and learn how to play these tunes, and then come back when we're ready. And the recording for us is 2 days.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, we're not going to spend 6 months in the studio or a year in the studio. I mean, I don't know why anybody does. That's just an extravagant waste of time and money. But we're not going to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So you do premiere music on stage and then record it later?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
And
absolutely, because in our business, you know, in our business, a lot of times when I do the generic interviews, meaning the interviews that are about when you're on tour, they want to say something in the paper, you know, or they're coming to town. So there's a guy interview and they'll ask questions, and one of the questions they'll say is like, so what can the audience expect? And I say, well, you know, they can expect new music. And they say, wow, so is it going to be all new music? I said, well, new to them. I mean, they're not jazz fans. They're music fans. And we're lucky enough to be in a discussion of people who are considered good at what they do. But they're not going to run out and buy a bunch of records and listen to it and come back and say, you know, play my jam. You know, play Dance of the Evil Toys. That's my jam. I mean, we're not in that business. We're not going to have people singing along with us. So most of the people that are coming to hear us, they're coming to hear us for the first time or the second time. They like seeing, using that word intentionally, because that's the operative verb in the United States. They like seeing us play, and they don't mind hearing us play, but they're not going to go out and buy the record. So it's easy to just premiere new music because it sounds to them like the old music.
So you mentioned that you record in a traditional jazz manner. You know, you go in, bang out the songs that you know, you've got a grip on them, you know, just one or two takes and go. Have you ever had any interest in making music that exploits the studio as an instrument?
Not in acoustic music, no. I had a band called Buckshot LaFunk, and we did that. But even then, it was only like 2 weeks. I mean, I just can't sit in there. I can't sit. Can't sit in the studio, you know, fucking around with a snare drum. It's just, you know, it's just, I mean, the Beatles didn't do that, you know.
Yeah, but the tech wasn't there. If the tech had been there, those guys would have been in there for 6 months, and you know it.
No,
McCartney would
it.
Never leave the studio, I don't think.
Well, he has plenty of opportunities post the Beatles to not leave the studio. I don't know how he does it, but I'm just, they bang those tunes out. Ray Charles banged those tunes out. Those are great records, you know? And then there's certain records, like when I was a kid, I used to listen to Dark Side of the Moon, and I would put headphones on to hear all that ear candy going on in there, and I love that shit. But when you're playing acoustic music, it sounds better recorded in large rooms where you can have leakage from other instruments. So because you can't get isolation, then you can't do all those things. And I don't necessarily think that jazz needs that. You know, I don't think that jazz needs that. I mean, we're touring musicians, and the recording is a reflection of what we've learned or haven't learned. Like, that's pretty much what it is. You know, it's, you know, it's, and there are some people who like that kind of music. It's like classical music. It's recorded in a big room. It's recorded in 2 or 3 days, and it's done. Like, that's, you know, that's what we practice for. That's what it is. We're not songwriters. We're players. A lot of times, in those bands, I mean, it's like songwriting bands. They don't play very well. It takes them longer to get solos together and get all that stuff together. Even though McCartney was a hell of a bass player since you brought him up, but yeah, I mean, there's just no need for us to do it. You know, in Buckshot, we did it. We sat around for weeks doing in post-production, doing all these, trying out all these wacky things. But in jazz records, just four dudes on a stage, man.
So was that something that bugged you when you were, you know, working with Sting, like being in the studio for a long period of time, or were you able to get in and get out?
No, it doesn't bug me, because the music, it works with the music you're playing. If we were with Sting playing, you know, an orchestral piece, I'd say, what the hell are we doing in here? You know, it's just, no, I mean, I enjoy the process either way. I mean, and I did get in and get out. I mean, I was in Barbados for a month, and I think the amount of time that I might have played the whole time might have amounted to 10 days. It's just, he wanted me there when he needed me. He was writing things, he was trying things, and then it'd be like, you know, what are you doing? I said, I'm not doing anything. I didn't play golf then, so I would have played a lot of golf, but I couldn't have because we didn't have cell phones, so I just had to be around. So I did things. I just, you know, ate a lot, practiced, and then they'd say, you know, Sting needs you, so you go in. No, I'm not opposed to that process. He didn't waste time like that. I mean, I'm talking about bands where they're in the studio for 2 years. I mean, what can you be doing in the studio for 2 years?
Yeah.
It's like, you can write this shit in your living room. Why do you have to fly to a studio to write your songs? It's just, I mean, I get it. They have a lot of money and they can do it. The successful bands make enough money where they can pretty much do that and get away with it. Less so now than in the past, but I just think for the sake of the music, it's just do what the Grateful Dead did, man. Just go in the studio, play the shit, and go home.
Yeah, yeah. You've been working in a trio or a quartet format since the 80s, basically. Why do you like being the only horn?
I don't know. Never thought about it. I mean, there's no other horn players other than my brother that I want to play with. I mean, the two trumpet players I play with are Terrence Blanchard and Wynton, and they're busy doing their thing. We don't need another horn. I mean, the band is very fluid. The band is very versatile. Like, we were doing something with Terrence once, and I realized that we can't play the way we normally play because now there's an additional person involved. So we can't just turn on a dime and do all of these things. Now, if he played with us long enough, then he would be in on it and he could do it. But it's just one of those things where I think, like, the first saxophone quartet was, like, you know, Coleman Hawkins. No, he didn't even really do it. But I think, you know, Lester Young did it, and everybody did it since then. And I don't miss the trumpet. If I missed having another horn, I'd get one. I just don't think I need it.
On your 80s records, I was looking, and you know, you did a lot of tunes by Ornette and Sonny Rollins and people like that, and you were kind of trying on hats, in a sense, it seemed to me, like adopting other players' styles for a piece at a time. Do you feel like at a certain point you developed a greater confidence and began speaking only in your own voice?
I was speaking in my voice then. It's just like, you know, your kid grows up. I mean, how you speak the language is based on what you watch on TV and what your parents talk like and what your relatives and friends talk like. So, you know, if you make the mistake like I did as a 12-year-old to start reading huge historical tomes, then suddenly your vocabulary starts changing. And then in high school, I was in theater and I started reading Shakespeare, and then your vocabulary changes. And all your friends say, "Man, you talk funny now. What happened to you?" I mean, this is music. I use that as an experience on how to play music. I always sounded like me. I mean, no one would hear me play and say, "Wow, is that Ornette?" They'd say, "Oh, that guy's been listening to Ornette." I mean, you have to have a vocabulary. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're just going to make the same record over and over and over and over and over again. And it takes decades for that music to become an actual part of you. So what I really wanted to do when I was making records, which I said somewhere in an interview in 1984 or something, all I'm going to do with these records is document how I feel a jazz musician should develop. And so I was very specific about who I was listening to. I would put it on the record. I would talk about emulating other styles. And then there was invariably pushed back against that, saying, you know, go out there and find your own voice. And I didn't know how to articulate it. But as I got older, I'm saying, well, I already have my voice. It's just not a very developed voice. And I can use two ways to develop a voice. I can use a pattern book, which everybody else was doing. And I wasn't really knocked out by that. Or I could just use the great people who came before me. And then as these records come out and you hear Charlie Parker, these recordings are now out with Charlie Parker playing like Coleman Hawkins, and Charlie Parker playing Lester Young solos, and Charlie Parker trying out all these things. I mean, I always felt that was the way that music is best learned, because we are playing for people who don't know anything. So if you sit around all day studying all these possible permutations, mathematical calculations, scales that correspond to pattern, then that becomes your language. So now you're going to play for people. What are they going to hold on to? How are they going to relate to it? That's one of the reasons people don't like jazz, is it sounds clinical. And it sounds like a bunch of people trying to reinvent something that does not need reinvention. So I just went in a different path. And now when we play, people like the way we sound. Or they don't like the way we sound. But they don't have to go to harmony class to figure out what we're trying to do. It's on the strength of all of those guys that I emulated that I can do this with the confidence I have now. Because, you know, you can't invent this shit out of whole cloth. You can't invent it from the ether. You just can't. You know, you just, no matter how many people say you can, it's not true. You know, since everybody always talks about innovation in jazz and they want to hear something new, think about it. for an untrained ear, and a lot of the critics that review jazz, they have untrained ear. A musician who learns no jazz vocabulary sounds new. Never heard it before. Doesn't make it good. Like I would have. So if the goal was to get credit as being some kind of innovator, it would have been in my best interest to learn no jazz at all and then play jazz, and then it would be this, you know, new savage language, and everybody go, man, that's different. That's killing. Nah, I really like jazz. I want to play jazz. Mm-hmm. The songs we play aren't vehicles for improvisation. Improvisation is a very small component of jazz. And when musicians or historians or who ethnomusicologists or whoever it was that decided that improvisation would be put at the forefront of jazz, that's when jazz got into trouble. It's not really about soloing. It's a sound. It's a beat. It's a pulse. It has all these great things in it, and soloing is a part of it. But soloing is not it.
Yeah. It's interesting because I was just talking to Gary Bartz about 4 days ago, and he said that he really dislikes the term improvisation and doesn't like when people talk about his music in terms of improvisation. You know, he says, I've composed this shit. It's an idea in my head. It's not, you know, I'm just not like finding the notes in the, you know, in the moment or whatever. I have this idea, you know.
I mean, people don't understand what improvisation is. You know, it's like a word that bounces around. I mean, if musicians wanted to be better improvisers for real, because what jazz improv is in schools is learning patterns and scales and arpeggios to outline chord structure. That's not spontaneous. That's just prepackaged and regurgitated. And you catch on to this whole thing where everybody's so, it's like we are as a nation so bad at language that we grab synonyms and treat it as fact. For instance, when I was a kid, the work I did with Sting, I would be called a sideman, which is what I was.
Mm-hmm.
Now they call me a collaborator. I did not collaborate with Sting. He hired me to play parts on his music. He didn't say, help me write this music. I didn't come in and say, yeah, man, those three bars in the middle, that shit don't really work. You should do this. Oh, Brian, you know, you're right. Fuck, man. It's his music. It's his idea. And what we do is we use what we know to complement what he does. That is what a sideman does. We're not collaborators. But we all, now you sit, talk to people, they say, you've collaborated with so many people. And I say, no, I've actually collaborated with few people. And that's the way the word improvisation is bandied about. I am not against the word improvisation because I want to view myself as some kind of composer, or it's just inaccurate. It's just what I'm starting to do with my students is I'm making my students take an improv class at the theater department at our school.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got guys saying they want to improvise. They don't have the first fucking idea how to improvise. So if you take a bunch of musicians and throw them in an improv class and force them to actually improvise, it would be great. Because most musicians that play jazz now, it's almost like the kids who used to wear goth in our high school, you know? It's like you got 11 kids in a school with 1,500 people and they wear all black and black lipstick and they stand in the corner and say, look at those losers. We're cool. They're a bunch of dicks. I mean, that's what jazz is. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of guys saying, yeah, man, we're fucking smart. We're geniuses and they suck. They don't know anything. They don't know what good music is. They don't know. And they're in the fucking majority, bro. It's like, you know, talk about a waste of time. So the whole idea is people like it when they feel things are spontaneous. But most things, they go, it feels prepared because it is prepared. It's overly prepared and simply regurgitated on command. The musicians don't communicate with each other in terms of body language or eye contact. They don't look like they're having fun, and they just start and stop at the same time. And that's not what improvisation is. It's totally not what it is. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to happen in the moment. And, you know, you get kids and put them in a theater class where they have to make these decisions based on what the teacher says, like, you know, like catch my snap. and the cat snaps his finger and throws it in your direction, and you have to snap to pick it up, and then you have to do things with your body language. You either bounce it on the ground, and the next person has to catch it. They have to look in the air like when you have a ball and catch it high. Or if they throw it high in the air, you have to look at it like you're catching a fly ball and catch it low. There's all these things you can do, and most musicians are trapped in this. Their brains are so linear, which again is an obstruction to improvisation. You have to find a way to unlock that shit. And practicing scales all day is not the way to unlock it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. What do you think was your biggest breakthrough as a player, whether it was learning how to do a specific thing on the horn or having a kind of aha moment in terms of your overall approach to music and way of thinking about music? Was there ever like a door that opened that you were like, all right, I'm in a whole new territory now?
My first big breakthrough is when I spent 2 years trying to learn how to play like Sonny Rollins, and it never came through. And I said, well, I gave it a good try. And then 8-9 months later, one day I played, and the shit came out of the horn. And I was like, whoa! I was really like, oh, shit! You know? But it wasn't like, you know, I cracked the code in terms of like, you know, now I'm ready. It was like, fuck, so it works. This is great. Now I got to go learn Lester Young and Wayne Shorter and Warren Marsh and Ornette Coleman and do all of these work, all this stuff, and get all of these sounds. And for me, it is a gradual process of learning. It is a gradual process of becoming. I remember talking to some students in Europe about this process. And the teacher says, you know, well, this is nice, but at some point you have to choose, don't you? I said, why? What are we, fucking accountants? I said, you want to play music, right? You have to choose what? When to stop learning? Well, okay, stop. You can do that. I mean, you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, songwriters, yeah, they don't need to keep learning. You know, it's such a small window for most of them. And if you get something that works, beat that to death. And then when they stop, you know, buying your records, at least you sold 100 million and you can live comfortably. I mean, I get that. But when you choose this path, when you choose this shit, you know, when you choose the path of most resistance, why not learn? Why not just continue to learn and continue to improve? What's the benefit of standing still? Nothing. So that was that great aha moment. And then it's just been a lot of aha moments. I mean, I remember the first time that I played a classical piece and didn't feel like I was hopelessly overwhelmed by it. That was 7 years into the process. That was more of a relief than an aha. Because I believed that if I kept suffering through it, that I would get over to this other side and be more comfortable in it. I didn't think it would take that long. I was relieved when it finally happened. I was like, thank you, Jesus. Oh, this was so hard. So, you know, I still don't play the piece as well as I'd like to. But I don't look scared and nervous when I play anymore. And I can have more fun on stage. Because people used to come to the concert and say, man, you just look like you have more fun playing jazz. I said, yes, because I know how to play jazz. I'm overwhelmed by this shit. How do you expect me to have fun? Mm-hmm. But now, I can play it and be comfortable in it. And that was nice. But there's no moment when I said, you know, I've got it, other than the template. The Sonny Rollins thing was like, okay, now I've got the template. Now I just need to keep working.
Yeah.
Keep listening to this shit. Keep doing. Keep learning how to play like Bechet. Keep learning, listen to all these guys, and then we can start playing music from those periods with a certain level of authenticity. So then we don't have to feel the need to change chords and do all these things so that it doesn't sound like shit to our ear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the players,
escape valve.
The players that have kind of permanently altered the vocabulary of the saxophone, like Rollins, Coltrane, Ornette, Eiler, Farrow, they're guys that you can hear in young players. Do you ever hear yourself in young players?
I hope not. No. I heard it in some guys, but I really told them that they really shouldn't do what they were doing. Because what they did was they took a couple of things that I played in my late 20s when my vocabulary was still crap, and they turned them into licks, and they just play them all the time. And I'm like, man, learn how to play. Don't just play these licks, especially mine. You know, just... it's a bad way to learn. And I think that they were more in the camp of, I want to learn enough of this shit to get a gig and not learn more of it. So, I mean, I think they still do it. I mean, too bad for them. But, you know, the music system is the most limited system in the history of systems. It's only 12 notes. So the idea that you're going to learn this shit through harmony is a joke. You only got 12 notes. Now, there are 20 ways to play those 12 notes. Sound is infinite. I mean, you know, the Arab scale has 21 notes, but they're not really notes. They're shades of sounds.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean? It's like, because they have all these notes that are in between two of our notes. And what that teaches me is like their ears hear sound differently than we hear sound. So let's learn some of that shit. Let's add that to the mix, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Let's learn the way that the Japanese play the shakuhachi flute. Let's add that to the mix. Because if you're playing something that's solitary, God, wouldn't you want to play it like they do? They play solitary better than anybody. So a lot of guys just keep adding more and more data. I just try to add more and more sound.
I'm not really.
I mean, if somebody wants to listen to me, great. But you know, the funny thing is that as a musician, as a saxophone player, and as a group, the stuff that we've played in the 2000s is way better than any of the other shit we've done. But most people come in talking about the shit we did in the 80s, which is like, that was when we were more traditionally like the linear modern players playing, you know, licks corresponding to chord structure and all of that. And it seems like once we broke free of that, a lot of musicians are more comfortable with that. And so they say, man, really dug you in the 80s. I'm like, yeah, well, that's one of us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
These are the dark keys.
I almost feel like the album The Dark Keys was kind of like a line in the sand, because it feels
it was actually Crazy People Music was a line in the sand.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't really a line in the sand. Crazy People Music was the first record that I said, wow, we're finally breaking free of this shit that everybody's doing. You know, and you could just break free of it by just not playing anything that's relative. But, you know, the other way, you know, the Einstein way is to thoroughly immerse yourself in all of the data and then see things in the data that the other guys don't see. So what we were able to do is hear sounds that the other guys weren't hearing. It wasn't through an avoidance of tradition. It was through the tradition that we arrived at this place. And I could tell we cracked it. And yeah, the Dark Keys was, I mean, you know, me and Tane, we had this thing. And, you know, we had listened to a lot of, you know, like these records, like the Ed Blackwell record with Dewey Redman, where it's just drums and sax the whole record. And some of it's a miss, but the hits are fucking great. I mean, we shared so many musical experiences together that we were really ready to stretch. And when the piano's not there, yeah, that's probably when I have my best playing. Even though I love playing with piano, I really don't want to spend a lot of time playing trio. I love what the piano, especially what Joey brings, not just the piano. If Joey leaves the band, I might go trio for a while because I haven't heard any other piano players that have the kind of imagination that he has. But yeah, the Dark Keys was a good record, man. It was good.
Yeah. It was just, I mean, I remember hearing it and thinking it was so stark and challenging compared to, you know, what I had heard from you before, that it was kind of like, all right, he's going to leave some people behind on this record, you know?
Yeah, well, we did that. There's a record called Bloomington where it was me, Tane, and Bob Hurst.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that was an earlier version of the same kind of thing where you know, it's just like we were clicking on all these cylinders and the music was moving in ways that people weren't going to be able to catch what that was. So we tried to make up for that with enthusiasm. It's a tough listen, even for music people, you know. It's a tough listen.
Yeah. You've made a number of appearances on stage with jam bands, Grateful Dead, Dave Matthews mm-hmm. Band, Dead and Company. Do you listen to that kind of music on your own, or do you just feel like they're open to what you're doing and it's fun, you know, stuff like that?
I listen to it a little bit, not as much as I would have in my 30s, because I'm doing other things.
Mm-hmm.
But I do listen to it. You know, if the guys are coming to town and they text me and say, you want to come up, I'll start checking out the music and listening. Because I remember the first time I played with the Dead, Phil was excited and the other guys were pissed because Phil kept bringing up, you know, he kept bringing up these jazz guys, you know, David Murray and Ornette came and they just do their shit on the top of the music.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't know me from Adam. So I could tell by the body language. So I was like, I'm glad you're here. And the other four were like, whatever, you know? So they brought me up on the last song of the first set. And I think what worked, because they didn't really realize that I had an electric music background and that I had learned how to play with people, not just on top of people. So I think that, you know, I think it was Birdsong was the first song we played. And then Jerry's eyes start to light up a little bit because he realizes I'm playing with him. I'm listening to him, responding to him, responding to the band. So, I mean, I was a band leader. They did what I would have done. You bring somebody up on the last tune of the first set and you fucking send them home, you know? And mm-hmm. then they say, yeah, that was great. Get out of here. So I just got to it. I said, well, look, guys, thanks for letting me play. This was fun, you know? And they said, no, stick around. Play the second half. I mean, I was like, okay, sure. And, you know, I think that when you play in a horn section, you have to be okay with being invisible. You know, you can't make it about you.
Yeah, yeah.
And I grew up like that. I grew up. Sting did these rainforest concerts for a while where he's raising money to help out the indigenous people in the rainforest. And he called me once and said, I need a horn section. We're going to do a Stax night. And I said, okay, I'll get back to you. And I got Lou Soloff, Tim Williams, and me. And he goes, well, you know, there's not any like step out moments for the horns. I said, man, I was in a horn section when I was 14. I love being in a horn section. I don't need step-out moments. Just do your thing and let me enjoy myself. I've never had a chance to play Stax tunes with any kind of consistency. I'm going to dig this shit. It's going to be great. And I was just in the horn section. And I played a solo on this song, "I Put a Spell on You," and Cropper turns around and says, "Damn, son, where are you from?" I said, "New Orleans." He goes, "Oh, okay, that explains it. Good solo." I was like, "All right, cool." I mean, that was, you know, but he didn't know who I was, and I didn't give a shit. I just loved playing. So when I play with the Dead, I'm trying to be invisible. I'm not trying to say, "Here I am, check me out." I'm trying to play the music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess my last question is, there are a lot of young players now, like some from London and others here, like Kamasi Washington and Christian Scott, who are reaching young rock and hip-hop listeners. Do you think that audience will prove loyal and open to a broader spectrum of jazz, or are they just Kamasi fans or just Christian Scott fans?
They are jazz fans as long as the jazz sounds like the shit they like. That's it. As long as it has, you know, like Kamasi's band is a hip-hop band with sax solos and some other solos. It's not a jazz band. You know, it has a static drum beat, not a fluid drum beat. And when you watch the audience bob their head, they bob their head as though they're at a hip-hop concert. So it's basically like, it's more like instrumental hip-hop than anything else. But by a lot of people's definition, all instrumental music is jazz. So what used to be instrumental R&B is now smooth jazz or contemporary jazz or whatever they call it. You know, I remember once there was a singing group called H-Town. And they had a song that was a hit called "Knockin' the Boots" in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did a remix of the song, and they basically had a church organ player who did like a 1/6-2/5 turnaround using minor chords, you know, minor, 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 5/7-1. And they said, "Yeah, we're doing jazz style now." I mean, it's like, you know, am I going to sit down and say, "Guys, this isn't really jazz"? I'm like, fuck it, yeah, jazz, okay. Because for me, I just want to play this music. And I want to play for the people who have the capacity to like it. And I'm totally cool with the people who don't have the capacity. But Kamasi's music is not going to lead anybody to Coltrane, no. That's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I was a fan of Herbie, of Headhunters, sometimes people would say, "Oh, yeah, well, you know, like what Herbie's doing now is going to lead people to jazz." Well, sure in the hell didn't lead me to jazz. I was like, Headhunters, whatever, fuck the rest of that shit. And then when I went to Berkeley, Smitty Smith, this great drummer, who's my roommate, he puts on this record, Nefertiti. And I'm looking at the album cover, and I said, "Is that the same Herbie Hancock that's in Headhunters?" He goes, "Yeah, man, you didn't know that?" I'm like, "No." And Wayne Shorter, "Is that the guy from Weather Report?" I mean... And I wound up being a jazz musician.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1979, I look at a record, I didn't know that Herbie played with Miles, or Wayne. So this idea that, you know, it reminds me of some of these people who are saying that, like, marijuana is a, I forgot the word they use, but a...
Oh, a gateway
a
drug.
A feeder drug to heroin.
Uh-huh.
A gateway drug. It's just hilarious. If you ever know any potheads, they don't become heroin addicts. It's just like, what are you talking about? A gateway drug. Statistics show that's bullshit. I knew too many people who smoke weed. They just smoke weed. So the idea that, you know, pop jazz is a gateway to jazz is ridiculous. But I think that those guys are playing the music that they're best suited to play.
Mm-hmm.
Because they wouldn't really function well in a jazz setting anyway. And I'm not saying that with any envy. It's just there's a whole lot of work that they would have to do. It'd be like when I decided to play classical music. I mean, I started in the latrine and clawed my way out of it. And it took 7 years before it was even remotely acceptable. That's what it takes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Christian Scott, the other guy, I mean, he's from New Orleans, and I know he's... I know who
Christian is.
Yeah.
Everybody from New Orleans doesn't grow up playing jazz. Christian Scott has all the talent and ability to play jazz. He chose otherwise. Trombone Shorty has all the talent and ability to play jazz. He chose otherwise. I don't resent them their choices. I love those guys. I love what Trombone Shorty's doing.
Yeah.
Everybody does. I mean, most like, you know, I remember, I mean, the Meters were playing around New Orleans. That's right. They called them the Neville Brothers, you know, not later, but they weren't even called the Neville Brothers. I mean, they would play gigs and, you know, Art Neville would see me and say, "Hey man, how's your dad doing?" I mean, we didn't grow up with that thing. You know, I remember I moved to New York and I came to a gig, David Sanborn gig, and Hiram Bullock was playing. And I said, "What's up, Hiram?" He goes, "What are you doing here? You're a jazz guy." And it was a joke, but it also was not a joke. But in New Orleans, everybody goes to everybody's gigs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a thing. So most of my friends that play music in New Orleans didn't grow up playing jazz. So what? We chose jazz. That's what we chose. You know, everybody wants to believe there's like jazz on every corner. You know, this shit is, it's not true. It's not true. The brass bands today play R&B. They don't play that trad music that Louis Armstrong and them play. That's their choice.
Okay, that was my interview with Branford Marsalis, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Thank you for listening, and please visit osirispod.com to check out other shows from the Osiris Network. And consider supporting Burning Ambulance on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. Osiris.